Here's to the paper pushers, the rush hour warriors, and the gotta get awayers. Trade the daily grind for a place to unwind, where you can rise with the tide and roll down the boardwalk, where you can eat french fries for lunch and ice cream for dinner, where your only commute is your walk to the beach, where every day feels like Saturday. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. This is a little bit of a different show. This is part of our crime and author series, and I have a really interesting author coming on today. And I'm going to put the book up on the screen that he's written. I'm excited to introduce Kevin Flynn, a distinguished author of the renowned Relentless Pursuit and former violent crime prosecutor whose latest novel, Rock Creek, launches on May 14th with over 35 years of battling violent crimes in Washington, D.C. That's what Kevin brings to this, his fiction writing. This book, set against the politically charged backdrop of 1952 Washington, D.C., Rock Creek is a gripping story of deep social divides and political corruption to the highest degree. The story centers around Shane Kinnick, a tormented homicide detective who delves into the murky murder of Emily Rose, a Capitol Hill staffer with a haunting history, in the enigmatic shadows of Rock Creek Park. So we're going to bring Kevin, and I mean, I'm looking forward to this. This is such an interesting story. And with someone that not just can write the right, walk the walk, he can do all of those and talk the talk, Kevin Flynn, because he was a prosecutor of 35 years. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce to you author, former prosecutor, Kevin Flynn. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Bill. I'm really thrilled to be here.
You know, Kevin, you know, one of the things, and I cover true crime, and I've been retired from the NYPD for 13 years. I did 27 years. And one of the things we notice now, especially in homicide investigation, for that matter, all types of investigation, is the amount of times, almost 100% of the time, that digital evidence comes into play. And that, I mean, even in the 13 years I've been out, I'm like baffled of what they can do. Your thoughts?
Oh, it's amazing. I wrote this book. I started writing it in 2007. I was on a sabbatical from my job. I took family leave because my kids were getting to a certain age and I was spending too much time at the office. I went back. I was gone from 2006 to 2009. In those 3 years, just those 3 years, the entire landscape had changed. With prosecuting cases, cell phones and cell sites were all of a sudden massively important, and to agree they hadn't been, and it's only accelerated since then. In the past, when I first started working at the U.S. Attorney's Office, almost all of our cases were just based on eyewitness identification, often stranger on stranger, which is a little bit scary looking back, given the potential. The potential for errors, especially in a stranger-on-stranger identification context. Now, it is very rare that we base any case on, when I say we, it's like I'm still at the U.S. Attorney's Office. Our cases were almost entirely based on either video surveillance, surveillance cameras, cell sites, cell phones, getting into not only cell phones, tracking them, but also getting into them by way of search warrants for content. It is just the entire landscape has shifted. And of course, I'm not even mentioning DNA. I wrote a book and it came out in 2007 called Relentless Pursuit. And it was about a double murder that took place in D.C. A mother and daughter were brutally killed and DNA evidence was significant in that case. And ironically, it was the first murder case in D.C. It went to trial in 1994 that involved DNA evidence at all. And the numbers were I mean, now the numbers are astronomical. If you get a hit, a DNA hit, you can prove beyond any doubt that it was the same person. Our odds were minuscule by comparison. 500 to one, these kinds of numbers, which sound, if you're at the racetrack, you're not going to bet a 500 to one shot. But in terms of the world of DNA, it was a much more inexact science. Now everything has changed, and largely for the better. I tried any number of cases that were based entirely on eyewitness testimony, and hopefully we got it right all the time. But there is something about the certitude of technological evidence which basically makes cases, has the potential to make cases much stronger.
You know, Kevin, even with like what you say, it brings me back to I was a robbery sergeant where we had robbery units in Manhattan, and I started out on the west side, then I was on the east side. And so lineups was something that were happening every single day. And as you say, eyewitness identification is considered to be unreliable. And especially if a victim sat at a computer screen and looked at 1,000 photos before, now their brain is turned to mush just from looking at all those photos. Now, if they pick someone out, our procedure was that gave us probable cause, but we had to do a lineup after that. So we would not do the lineup the same day, because a defense attorney would say that person, the complainant, isn't picking the perpetrator out because she remembers what he looked like from the crime. She's picking him out because she remembers what he looked like from the computer screen. Right. So we used to have to keep that in mind and that not do the lineup that same day. So again, eyewitness, I was not always confident with it, but it was the best system we had back then. And then just quickly, I don't want to spend too much time on this, they came up with something called a double blind lineup. And I was just like, oh, how is that going to work? You know, and I couldn't believe that was actually be doable. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think MPD started requiring double blind identification procedures probably about 10 years ago. And when I say MPD, that's short for the Metropolitan Police Department, which is the DC local police department. And double blind basically was defined as having a detective who was not involved in the case be the person who was responsible for showing the photo spread to the victim, because there was a perception that there would be a danger if a detective was actually invested in the case may say or do something in the course of the identification procedure which would lead the witness toward a particular result, picking a particular picture or something like that. So that's all double blind meant, at least in MPD parlance. We stopped doing physical lineups some years back. They were hard to put together first. You'd have a suspect, then you'd have to put together 8 people who resembled the suspect enough that it would not be an unfair lineup, which created difficulties. So that's MPD stopped doing lineups some years back. So photo identifications were strictly by way of identification procedures were strictly by way of photographs, which are obviously much easier to assemble, so that you're picking out photographs, you're putting together a photo spread of people who look enough like the suspect that it is not unfairly prejudicial to have the suspect in the same lineup. For example, you would never, or in the same photo spread. For example, a constitutionally unfair, and this is an extreme example, but a constitutionally unfair identification procedure would be one that consisted of a photo spread being shown to a witness that consisted of 8 Asian American males and 1 African American male, with the African American male being the suspect. Obviously, that's unfair and would not be something that would be done. But it is, I left out one other source of information that we base our cases on, and that's criminal cooperators, which is another whole subject. And always have to be corroborated in every which way before you put on somebody like that. But the means that are now at the disposal of law enforcement, I think, have the potential to lead to results which are much more ironclad than the results potentially of a case that was relying entirely on stranger-on-stranger identification.
Absolutely. You know, Kevin, I want to get to your book, although, you know, we could give a seminar on double-blind lineups, but we're not going to do that. We want to, the reason you're here is to plug your book and to tell us about your book. So this is obviously a little outdated, but this is the book, Rock Creek, and you can get it from Amazon. You can go on Amazon. And now, Kevin, we spoke off camera. This story is based on a real life story. It's fiction, but it's based on some real life characters. You want to tell us about that a bit?
Sure. It's inspired by a case that I worked on back between 2002 and 2006. And that was a case involving a victim named Chandra Levy. She was a DC intern who became involved in an affair with a congressman. She went missing in 2001. And she was last seen going into Rock Creek Park, or was last known to have gone into Rock Creek Park, which is a massive park that basically divides DC. It runs north-south from maybe about 20-25 blocks north of the White House, all the way up 16th Street. It's several miles wide, goes all the way into Maryland, and that was where she was last seen or last known to be going into. Her body was found about a year later, and in the interim, because of the fact that she was known to have been involved with the congressman, he became a suspect between 2001 and 2002. I was not working on the case at that point. I worked on it for 4 years, left my office for 3 years to go on a family-related sabbatical, started writing the book in the meantime, but did not want to write a book that was in any way derived from true facts involving Ms. Levy's background. And so I decided to fictionalize the case, put it back 50 years, and create an entirely different backstory for the victim. So the victim in my case is her name is Emily Rose. She is she's a congressional staffer. She becomes involved in an affair with a congressman. She ends up being killed. Her body is left in Rock Creek Park. And the congressman is a suspect, is suspected in my book, along with other people who were in her circle. One of the wrinkles in the book, which I think is resonant with today's times, is that a black male who was seen in her presence before she died is arrested and charged with the murder. And a lot of the book deals with the various themes of sloppy police work, sometimes corrupt police work, prosecutors and police officers who are on the right side and trying to get to the truth of the matter, basically racism and how it affected the criminal justice system in 1952 in the same way that it still affects it to this day to some extent, although in no way, shape, or form as badly as it was back in the 50s. So the book is inspired by, but it's not based on the Levy case. One of the challenges in writing the book was to create a backstory for the victim, Emily, that was different than the story of Chandra Levy, which I did not want to exploit. The victim in Rock Creek has a very tragic and mysterious background, which is revealed over the course of the book. So her story is much different than anyone in real life. And as every novel is prefaced, every novel is prefaced with the message. This is a fictional account. It is not based on any resemblance to any person living or dead. It's purely coincidental. That's what I would say here as well. But I have to say that I did bring my experience with that case and also my experience in investigating and trying violent crime cases, including many homicide cases. I brought all of that to bear in terms of my writing of the book.
Kevin, let's talk about the finding of a female body in 1952 and the evidentiary capabilities you had in 1952 as compared to finding a female body in 2024. What, I mean, there's huge, huge differences. And the game changer, of course, is DNA. Is that, because, I mean, as you spoke about, I think you said 1994 was one of the first DNA cases in D.C. In Manhattan, New York, it was featured. I spoke to you off camera on Homicide New York, and it was the Aaron Key case. And that was the first time they were able to link through DNA a serial murder in New York State. Can you hear me, Kevin?
You were coming in and out of there for a moment, but now I hope we're back. It froze up a little bit.
Oh, okay. So what I was saying was, talk about the differences in the technology today as compared to what would have been in 1952.
Sure. No, it's interesting because when I wrote Rock Creek and I was in the process of writing it, I was bringing, as I said, my experience in law enforcement and doing these investigations, but I'm very mindful of the time period in which I was writing. So it was, for example, when you're writing a book like this, you have to be aware of the fact that people even getting characters from one place to another was different back in 1952. Nobody had cell phones. That's the obvious thing right there. But even back then, police officers had to go to call boxes to get back with either their office or other officers, whatever. Walkie talkies were rudimentary. So there was a level of technological simplicity which does not exist today. And so as I was preparing to write the book, I actually went back into historic Washington Post. When I started writing this, I thought I was going to have to be spending all my time in libraries looking at microfiche. But in fact, you have at your disposal with the internet all the Washington Post going back to the early 1900s. So I could literally track, and I did track, I tracked about 50 some homicide cases that took place between, that were investigated and tried between 1949 and 1952 to get a sense for how the police went about solving cases. And it was much different. You did not have the scientific evidence. You didn't have other technological means that are now at the disposal of police and prosecutors. So, the way the book begins, there's a flashback scene that begins the book, but then the action begins with just a skull being found in grass in Rock Creek Park and having to build from that.
Kevin, talk about, okay, you find the skull in the park. What are how are the detectives going to proceed? I'm always interested in that. What are they going to do next? I mean, are they going to photograph it? Are they going to do a canvas around the area? Are they going to call the medical examiner to come to the scene? Are they going to call the district attorney to come to the scene? How are they going, 1952, they're going to go about investigating a skull found in a park?
Well, in my book, the way it happened was that the detective, Shane Kinnick, he's on the outs with his department because of issues that he's been charged with by way of disciplinary proceedings unfairly. He's been on the outs. He's handling cold cases, not active cases, and he's really in a bad place in his career. He gets called to this scene because they think it's not going to lead to anything. It's a skull in the park, it's not even clear at first whether or not it's an animal skull or a human skull. He at least knows enough when he gets there to see that it's human, and he's able to track through a somewhat laborious process by just on foot to a place on a hill where the rest of the remains are, skeletalized remains, which are still in the clothing of the victim. And from there, though, all he has is he has a skull that was found at the bottom of the hill. He has a skeletalized body that is found inside clothes, and he's got to go from then on. And a good part of the first part of the book is him trying to track down who this person was and who they might have been. And so back then, the next step would be you go into missing persons records. And the only clue that he had was that inside of her clothing, there was a piece of jewelry or a piece of a personal possession which had a monogram on it. And so by going into all of these records, and they did have missing person records, of course, at that time, all of which were, on paper with carbon paper and all these antiquated forms of preserving records. He goes in and is able to determine that there was one person whose initials fit the initials that were on the personal property of the body that was found in the park. By that, he's able to track back to who she was, and then take it from there by finding out more about her background, finding out about her coworkers. He finds out about her affair that she was having with a congressman, and it takes it from there. But it's back in 1952, it was a much more laborious process in terms of solving a case like this. And frankly, I don't know. I mean, if it were a real life case in 1952, it would be kind of a miracle that it would be solved. The benefit of fiction is that I can make things up, and I can, you know, I can have a case be closed that might not have gotten closed back in 1952.
Right. You know, it is pretty amazing, because one of the people that don't understand homicide investigation, probably one of the most important things is identifying the victim, because from there you can start building what we call a victimology, the study of the victim, where the victim lives, victim's relatives, relationships the victim has, where the victim works, where the victim last was, her sexual proclivities, whether she drinks or not. You know, all of these things are part of victimology, and somewhere, usually, if it's not too complex, is the answer.
That's right. It's funny, even with all of the technological advances that we've talked about, a lot of solving homicide cases just comes down to who was the victim and where did it happen. You know, what you just talked about, victimology is so important in a particular kind of case. Certain kinds of cases, it's less so. For example, cases that are maybe gang-related violence, things of that nature, they still play a part. Definitely in a case where a domestic case or a case that involves acquaintances of the victim potentially. And also the second thing that I just mentioned is where it happened. The Levy case in real life happened in a remote part of a very sprawling and wild park. The location of the murder was completely at odds with the idea that a congressman would have been involved, in doing it. There would have been any number of ways if the congressman had wanted to do this, that he would have been able to do it in a way other than just tracking somebody who's jogging through Rock Creek Park. I can't tell you the number of cases that I've had over the years that just came back to analyzing where something happened, where the place was that the murder occurred. And a more recent example is a case that involved an intern that was killed back in 2016 named Seth Rich. I'm privy to some details about that case that I can't share, but I can say that the following. There were a lot of conspiracy theories that his political work resulted in his being killed. He was murdered back in 2016 on a street in D.C. He had been a Democratic National Committee staffer. Conspiracy theories went wild with the fact that that his murder had something to do with his political background and that it was somehow a hit. And all I can say, I can say just based on where this happened, that there is no way that this was a hit. It was a street crime. It was a robbery gone bad. And you could tell that just from even what's been made public about the crime scene itself. So, and there was nothing to your point also about his victimology that suggested that about his victim background that suggested that he would have been the target for something like that, as opposed to somebody who was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So to your point, who the victim was and where it happened, two things that are great starting off points for any kind of investigation.
You know, I just think that knowing what we know about homicide and how advanced it is and using all the technological advances, how difficult it had to have been in 1952. You don't have video cameras. They come into play in almost every single case. You don't have cell phones. You don't have computers, right? And even there's no DNA. The technology in collecting the evidence, it's all what they used to call gumshoe work.
Well, there's a
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Head to White Castle for 12 crispy, all-white meat chicken rings for just $3.99. For a limited time, choose from Classic, Hidden Valley Ranch, or our new Smoky Barbecue flavor, and take home 12 chicken rings for just $3.99. White Castle, follow your crave.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Find in the book that I think you'll appreciate, and I'm not going to be able to quote it directly, but it essentially it's describing the process that you're just talking about here. And it basically says that, you can put aside everything having to do with a police officer that has to do with the glamour of the job or all of the aspects of the job that are sensationalized, the riding around in cars or being able to put on lights and sirens and the uniform and all the rest of that. Really, the essence of a good cop comes down to one thing, and that is a good cop knocks on doors. And the best detectives that I worked with in the course of my career were the ones who, number one, were honest, but number two, were willing to get up at oh dark 30, which was a phrase I'd never heard before before I became a prosecutor, military phrase, I think, in its beginnings, but would get up in the middle of the night and bang on doors and just talk to people. But one thing I think that the one area where I think police had an advantage over today's police in 1952 was that I believe that people were more willing to talk to the police. And there wasn't as much, for my historical research, I can't say this with complete 100% confidence, but my research suggested that there was much less retaliation against witnesses than there is now. A good part of my work over the course of over the 25 or 30 years that I was involved in homicides was witness protection, making sure that witnesses who came forward were safe. That was something that was really not even considered in a case outside of a mob case. You heard about witnesses testifying before Congress in the 50s in mafia investigations that were in witness protection. It was not a part of day-to-day police and prosecutors' jobs back then, and it didn't become really so until the early part of my career, where the phenomenon of retaliation against witnesses became something that was prevalent and something that we had to spend a considerable amount of our time and efforts taking care of to the extent that we could. And I lost two witnesses in the course of my career, and I still really mourn over those. They were two people that that we had warned not to go into particular areas, and that they'd ended up going to those areas. And there were two people who had refused to go into fuller witness protection. So I do think in that sense, I think that there was more cooperation between the public and the police. More eyewitnesses came forward than they do now. It's harder to get cooperation from witnesses than it was then, I believe. And I also think that there was I think and this is a very sad part of a sad commentary on on the way law enforcement and the criminal justice system worked in the 1950s, but it was and for years later, but it was, I mean, sloppy police work was not necessarily punished, and corrupt police work was not necessarily punished either. But technologically, you're certainly, it's definitely, you know, it's certainly a fact that the job is easier now than it was then.
Well, it was the old expression that the ends justified the means that you used to get the results that you got. And right. That's what police departments, and not just police departments, DA's office, politicians, they turned a blind eye perhaps to, you know, overzealous police work perhaps. If they got, you know, it's just like the whole thing. If a cop is killed, it used to be there were no rules, you know. You didn't need warrants. You boomed doors and you found out who killed the cop. I mean, that doesn't exist anymore, but that was the way it used to be. High profile murders in Manhattan. They may say, oh yes, every murder gets the same attention. That's bullshit. You know, you do a murder below 96th Street, you're going to see the National Guard there. I'm exaggerating, but you're going to see more detectives assigned. And that's just a fact. Something, a murder happens in Central Park, it's international news, you know? So that's the politics. And I'm sure Washington, D.C., being a political animal, probably second, maybe not even second to New York, maybe first, politics play a part in crime fighting.
You're right. And that is actually, you've touched on what is a pretty significant theme in my novel, Rock Creek. And that is a murder of a Black person in D.C. in 1952 was treated with minuscule as being much less important on a scale than a murder of any white person, especially of a white person of affluence and importance. What's interesting about Rock Creek Park as a geographical character really in the book is that the park divided the white and the Black areas of D.C. You might be
familiar with the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah. And so murders that happened east of the park, which were the neighborhoods that were dominated by African Americans, were almost put to one side. Murders that happened west of the park, which was the more affluent area that includes Embassy Row, it includes Georgetown, it includes and it still to this day includes the most affluent areas in D.C. Those murders were treated with much more. There was much more effort expended on solving those murders and taking the perpetrators, or I should say, maybe even alleged perpetrators, to trial and convicting them. So it's a big part of the book, and the fact that in my book a white female is found dead in Rock Creek Park causes a massive sensation, within the police department there is literally a scene in which police officers are dispatched to all of the poor Black areas of the city to track down who it was that was responsible for the killing of this white female who ended up dead in Rock Creek Park, and the ramifications that come from that particular action, that law enforcement action, where it's assumed more or less, the default setting was that this was, if it wasn't the congressman who was involved, it was somebody who was a person of color. And so that's the over aggressive and brutal tactic that is resorted to by the police in Rock Creek. And then there are ripple effects that include considerable social protests that arises, and sort of like the nascent beginnings of the civil rights movement as it would have existed back in the 50s in D.C. I took a little bit of liberty with that. The civil rights movement actually did not really take root in D.C. until the later in the 50s. This takes place in 52. My theory, though, was that if a Black person was perceived in the community to be treated unjustly by the criminal justice system, it in and of itself would spark a protest, and that could lead to bigger things. And so that was a building block for my plot. But it's your observation that high profile cases are treated differently, even to this day, by police departments and prosecutors is spot on.
But, you know, Kevin, one of the things, too, and there's no doubt there was racism, much more racism back in 1952 than there is now. But let's face it, what we used to call them perp on perp murders. They're the hardest ones to solve because no one saw anything and no one's cooperating because it's perceived even in the hood. The guy's a player. He's playing in the drug trade. He's a bad guy himself. I'm not risking my life testifying. I know who shot him. I'm not telling you, you know?
Right.
And so there's other things that come into play other than racism. It also has the socioeconomic conditions around the murder, or and are both people involved, or many people involved in the murder, are they players in the criminal trade? And if they are, John Q. Citizen doesn't want to raise his right hand.
Right.
And say, yeah, I saw it. No.
That's absolutely true, Bill. I handled a gang trial back in 1995, there were two gangs actually in D.C. There's no such thing as a big gang in D.C. The gangs are smaller, and they're numerous. There are not the Crips and the Bloods or anything like that that there are in L.A. or other big cities. They're called crews, and there are the last count. I would keep track when I was at my job up until 2023, the number of crews and where they were located in the city, and for a small city, I mean DC is only has only a population of about 600,000. There were 87 separate crews in DC back in 2022-2023.
And Kevin, let me just interrupt you for 1 second. I have a reason for this.
Sure.
And you tracked them, and the police department tracked them, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How do you feel about certain powers that be want to take that tool away from the police from doing that?
Yeah, there's a way to keep track of where these crews are operating and who the members are.
Well, Kevin, how about someone's arrested? Are you a gang member?
Well, that's just
yes, I am. The fact what is, gang?
Yeah, the oftentimes our database, the gang database, was developed from debriefings that were done with defendants who had pled guilty and were looking to give information in exchange for a more lenient sentence or some other benefit from the system. And so this kind of information can be developed very benignly and very responsibly by way of interviews and other data collection that does not go toward painting an entire neighborhood with a broad brush
But for future crimes, don't you want to use that database? And how about this tattoo database? One of the people that kept that in New York City was Rikers Island. The correction office Cape kept a gangbanger tattoo database. How useful could that be in a murder investigation? In a robbery investigation, it's you, but there are people that want to take those tools away from the police.
Yeah, I don't really understand that. I get any sort of law enforcement tactic that seems to generalize or stereotype people who live in a particular neighborhood or people who are of a particular racial identity or whatever. That would be a pernicious law enforcement practice, but simply developing by way of interviews and other means information about people who are perpetrators of crime and are associates of a criminal group is completely legitimate to me. It's also one other thing let me just circle back just for a second to something you said about perp on perp crimes. In 1995, we were able to put an eyewitness on who was not involved in any gang activity. That was the last time I was able to put on an uninvolved eyewitness to a homicide in a gang-related case. I tried four other gang-related cases, actually tried three, supervised another trial intensely, and in none of those cases was an eyewitness willing to come forward. It was all based on information that we had developed by way of cooperator interviews, cooperator testimony, and also one other thing which I haven't touched on technologically, but which I know you're very familiar with, Bill, and that is tracking of guns, ballistically tracking guns. When I first I got involved in a gang investigation, a colleague of mine had started it. I became involved with it in 2017, took it to trial in 2022, and a major part of that investigation was tracking about 50 or 60 some guns that were connected to various incidents that ended up being relevant to the core violent crimes that were under investigation. And particularly, you know, one gun, which was a 10 millimeter that ended up getting tracked to two murders and multiple other street shootings, and all ended up being tracked back to the lead defendant in the case, Derek Turner. And I'm sure you probably know from your law enforcement experience that a 10 millimeter is an unusual gun. And so it's so that in and of itself was distinctive. And I'm not sure. I know that there was some ballistic capability for law enforcement back in the 50s, but nowhere near the level of exactitude that the science offers now.
Well, I think one of the biggest things that technological from ballistics was something called brass catcher. And brass catcher, simply the extraction tool inside a semi-automatic leaves marks on a ejected casing that is unique to that firearm. And one of the things that we found out in New York City, and I'm sure it wasn't unique to New York City, was that guns were being lent out to do work, you might say, to use the mafia expression. Someone needed to do a piece of work. They borrowed the gun. So as you said, a gun that a 10 millimeter had three or four murders on it. And how did the police know that? Well, because the brass in the Bronx matched the brass in Manhattan. The brass in Manhattan matched the brass in Queens. And there's another mark on the that the firing pin makes on the primer that is also unique to that firearm. So when these guns, semi-automatics, spit out these casings, that's why they're so important. And you'll see it in this day and age, real smart shooters will try to clear up their brass. It's hard to find, obviously, but there's one of the ways they may try to take the evidence with them. But that is how we track criminals. That's how we track firearms. And 1952, they did not have that technology.
That's right. And you know, one of the things that I alluded to was, and I've a couple of times here, is that the process of using the accounts and the information and the testimony of gang members to build gang cases against higher ups, and I'm sure Bill, you know from your experience that you always work from the bottom up, you never work from the top down, and you're basically working. Oftentimes the first debriefing you do, it's all new to you. You're getting introduced to an entire world of a gang that you don't know about, but you're getting corroboration if you're lucky and you're able to get enough guilty pleas, and you're doing confidential debriefings on, you know, with these various gang members as you're working your way through, they start to corroborate each other. But one of the things which always it's an essential piece of corroboration, and we were always looking for it, was information that individual gang members were giving about guns that were being used in various in various crimes of violence. The one thing that I found over the years of debriefing, I don't know if I can say hundreds, I don't know if I can put a number on it, but a fairly significant number of perpetrators of crimes, particularly in groups, was that the two things that they could always remember were guns and cars. What kind of gun somebody used when they saw somebody used or they themselves used, and what kind of cars were being used, to go from here to there. Guns and cars were something that we always focused on. And so the kind of process you're talking about, which was firearm identification, was a really essential part of our being comfortable with knowing that what we were being told by a criminal cooperator was accurate. Because if he or sometimes she were to tell us, well, we know that I know that Fats used a 10 millimeter to kill Jack on June 14th of 2016 or whatever. Maybe it just comes up with a summer of 2016, but we have other information that on that scene that is loosely described by the cooperator might not be with exactitude, but might be an exact date and time, but June, Waller Place, Trenton Park, whatever. And we know that the gun that was used on that scene, we know scientifically that it was in fact a 10 millimeter. That gives us a level of confidence in going forward with that cooperator, because you're always, when you're dealing with a cooperator, you know, by definition, you're dealing with someone who has committed crimes and has an incentive to try to convince you that they are telling the truth because they are looking to get a deal. They're looking to get a better sentence or whatever. So corroboration by, yeah, sometimes the best testimony, we would get eyewitness or other kinds of testimony that weren't scientific, but the science would corroborate the account that we were getting. It made us confident that what we were getting was the truth, and we could put that truth in front of a grand jury or a jury.
You know, I think that when you talk about this and cooperating witnesses and taking down gangs, I think at the highest common denominator, you have to look at the Italian mafia, who is not even in the same league of what they were in the 70s, 80s, 90s because of cooperators and RICO. Those four letters, you say it to someone in the mafia, they'll, oh no, that was the downfall of the mob, RICO, which stands for racketeering influence corrupt organizations. And that was used, and perhaps it's overused today, but that was used to build like conspiracy cases. And that's how they put these guys away. They weren't facing 5 or 10, they were facing 30 years, 50 years. And if you're facing 50 years, you're going to sing like a parakeet.
Right. I tried, the gang cases that I worked were all on the DC Superior Court side, which is, it's kind of an anomaly in DC. It is an anomaly. It's a unique characteristic of the office, of the U.S. Attorney's Office. Because DC isn't a state, the federal U.S. Attorney's Office prosecutes local crimes of violence, with the exception of juvenile offenses. And so there are two parts of my office.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
One is the federal side, the other is the D.C. Superior Court side. And for most of my career, I was on the D.C. Superior Court side. We did not have RICO, but we could charge people with, on the local side, we could charge them with criminal conspiracy, which is it's a very expansive legal statute, and it's a great tool for prosecutors. But if it's used in the wrong way, it can rope people into long stretches of incarceration who were comparatively, whose involvement in the essential crimes of violence was comparatively small. And I'll give you a quick example, if you don't mind. In a gang case that we tried back in the mid 2000s, in 2004, 2005, we had a defendant who was charged with conspiracy to commit murder, therefore first degree murder, the crime of first degree murder based on a conspiracy theory, when what he did was he knew that his gang was feuding with another gang. He had a car. Other people in the gang didn't. He had access to a car. He was approached. He was told that the other members of the gang wanted to go over to a school where the rival gang members were to assault them. He takes them over. He lets them out. He does not know they have guns. He hears gunfire. He leaves without even being a getaway driver. But he was on the hook for first-degree murder while armed because it was a foreseeable consequence of what he knew they were going to do, that violence was going to be done, and that that someone could get killed. That's how vast, how broad the conspiracy statute is, not just in D.C., but really everywhere in the U.S. If that statute is misapplied by a prosecutor, doesn't really have essential fairness in as the essential goal, that person is going to end up potentially spending 30 years in jail, mandatory minimum, for something that he had comparatively little involvement in. In other words, legal culpability, but not necessarily moral culpability. So,
Kevin, it's been taken to the extreme where this, I think California doesn't want to charge people with acting in concert. So it can get ridiculous. You know what I mean? I understand what you're saying, and a just prosecutor may pull those facts back and say, hey, I don't think he knew they were going to do this. But you're also getting into the head of the guy that was driving. I mean, you know, gangbangers, people doing it, they can't tell the truth if their life depended on it. So you're going to believe them. But again, well, are we going to lose acting in concert? You know,
I don't want that to happen at all. All I was just saying was that when I took this case over from another prosecutor, and this particular driver was the first person we looked at as being someone that we would want to approach cut a deal, get information, which ended up being corroborated. He ended up being a witness. And it's actually kind of an inspiring story. He pled to a lesser offense, testified, corroborated in every which way by all this other information that he didn't know that we knew. And as you know, Bill, the first rule in sitting across from a criminal cooperator is get, don't give. You don't tell them anything that you know. You just get their information. And he ended
good criminals always try to question the detective.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It's like trying to, you're like, I'll ask the questions.
Exactly. Yeah. So he ended up serving an appropriate amount of time in jail for what he did, and then got out, went into witness protection, and still was keeping in touch with me every couple of years for years, just to tell me that he had gotten married, he'd settled down, he had a job. And I had several cooperators that I worked with over the years get back in touch with me after they had done their time and talk about the rehabilitative process. And if there's one thing that I think helped me as to writing fiction, which I had never written before I took a crack at this, was being able to create characters that are full bodied and are multidimensional, because I learned over the years that not every hero is as heroic as you might think they are, and not every criminal is evil or as maladjusted as you think they are. And I got to, as I'm sure you did too, I got to know people over the course of interviewing defendants and working face to face with people who were witnesses for me in my cases, and I got to know them as people. And I think that there's a great phrase that every saint has a past and every sinner has a future. And that helped me create characters in this book, I hope, that are going to resonate with readers as being not just cardboard cutouts, but people who are actually full bodied and carry some interest for the reader.
That's great. The book is Rock Creek. The author is Kevin Flynn, a 35-year prosecutor from Washington, D.C., This is fiction, but it's modeled after a real life case that occurred. You can get this book on Amazon, order it on Amazon. It's going to be true to life. There's no doubt, because once the author brings to the writing a 35-year prosecutorial career, he's seen it all. And that's this book, Rock Creek, novel by Kevin Flynn. Kevin, you know, what you were talking about before, it sort of struck a note with me, because criminals sort of, they gain a respect for cops that they wind up liking, and vice versa in a way. But it doesn't mean you're not going to do your job to try to put them away. But there's a sort of a mutual respect. And we see that over time. And we see that, you know, when you're working with violent crimes, when you're working with murders, it's an underworld. It's a different area that, you know, most people never see. And I used to always say, well, I'm not going to coin this phrase, but Cops are voyeurs. You get to see things that no one else does. And there's sort of a thrill behind that, you know? I remember in the movie Serpico, there was a line in the movie, and I thought it was so true. He says, this woman asks him, I forget the character, that movie's so old and dated, but she says, Frank, why did you become a cop? He goes, I used to see crime scene tape around and everyone in the neighborhood looking, and they were like, what happened in there? No one knows, but guess what? The police know what happened, you know? Yeah. And I thought that was pretty interesting. That's so true. Is that the only reason someone's going to become a cop? Because they get to know what happens behind that yellow tape?
Yeah, it was, you know, and you talk about the respect that can be developed between, you know, law enforcement and you know, people who have committed crimes of any name, whether drug-related, violent crime, whatever. And the one thing that I found and developed over time was that I tried to treat everybody, even someone who I knew based on the evidence that was familiar to me, had likely committed a very, very serious crime. And I was sitting across from them for the first time, for the first interview. I always treated them with respect. I never called them by first name. I never called them by a nickname. It was Mr. This. They called me Mr. as well. I never raised my voice. You know, and the rule that I followed and that I trained other prosecutors to follow was that if you're sitting across the table from someone who's been charged with a crime, first the lawyer is always in the room because you can't have any contact with them if the lawyer's not in the room if you're a prosecutor. And second, you have to realize
is that a Virginia rule? Because that's not the rule in New York.
In DC, well, it's actually a bar rule. It's a rule that like detectives don't, our police officers are not bound by the same rule. But if a defendant has been charged and is represented, we have to go through their counsel to
right, right. Well, that I understand, but it's just like the media sometimes, or even people will say the police interviewed him without his lawyer. Oh. I always try to explain to them, I said, if the lawyer's involved, there's no interview. So stop. You're showing tremendous ignorance. Right. If the guy invokes counsel, there is no interview.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. Yeah. But if he waives, then you can have at him. You know, that's the best. Some of the detectives that got the best statements, they were the best at being able to legitimately and lawfully secure Miranda waivers from defendants, and not in a coercive way, but just in a way that was just by going at it the right way. Yeah, some of the detectives I found least effective that I worked with over the years were the ones who treated the reading of rights as being just formulaic, and you know, we're going through the motions here. You're going to invoke.
Kevin, you know, there's a word we use in New York. It's called schmooze. It's a Yiddish word.
Oh yeah.
They schmooze the defendant to get him to waive. But you know something? Now that's all videotaped. So a defense attorney may not like the way you schmoozed the guy to get him to waive Miranda.
Well, yours, I guess in DC. DC was one of the first police departments back. This goes back at least 20 years. To require videotape interviews of actually all witnesses, not even just defendants, and I think it's a great thing. I think transparency.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Hey, parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With law enforcement is always a good thing. Body worn cameras, good thing.
I was initially against body worn cameras, and now I see how effective they are. And usually, 99% of the time, it shows the police were right, and it shows they did the right thing. And perhaps it also changes conduct because the cop knows I'm on video. I'm not gonna do something stupid or curse or do it. I mean, cursing, they seem to me, comes hand in hand with police work because you're scared sometimes, police don't fucking move. You're not going to say police, please don't move. That's ridiculous. If you're scared, someone has a gun or something, you're going to use street lingo, and they might not like it when they see the body worn video played,
Right. That's exactly right. I think if I'm not mistaken, MPD started taping interviews. Maybe it was probably 15 or so years ago. But the best statement that I ever saw be elicited from a defendant was all on videotape, and it was not only effective because the detectives treated the defendant with respect, and there was no bullying, there was no over aggressiveness, but also because they got the defendant it was a baseball bat murder. And the defendant was claiming self-defense. And on the videotape, they got the defendant to act this whole scenario out according to what his account would be. And the jury was able to, caught on videotape, you saw just how ludicrous the story was, because he's actually having to put himself and the decedent, in terms of this reenactment, in positions that there would have been no self-defense whatsoever. So, and you couldn't capture that. If that interview wasn't videotaped, first, the jury wouldn't have seen how respectfully and intelligently the detectives, who I'll give them a shout out here, Ed Truesdale and Michael Irving from MPD, both retired now from MPD. They did a phenomenal job, and they were respectful always with the defendants they were interviewing. But they were also very clever in terms of doing something that they would never have been able to reenact in court. The jury would have been looking at them like, what do you mean? But because it was on videotape, it was an extraordinarily effective piece of evidence, and it ended up really sinking the defendant in that case.
Kevin, in the same vein, and I used to say this when I taught at the NYPD criminal investigation course, I'd get loaned out from homicide and I would go teach. And one of the things is that good paperwork is the cornerstone of professionalism. And I have this detective in mind from the 2-3 squad, this guy Billy Dunn, and I read one of his DD5s, which is a complaint follow-up, and it was an interview of this perpetrator that murdered somebody. And he said, when I first sat down, he got him to wave Miranda. I won't go through the whole thing, but he said, I offered him a chance to go to the bathroom and to get a drink of water. And he documents all of that. Time stamp. An hour later, I offered him, I asked him if he wanted anything to eat. At 1,200 hours, I picked him up a cheeseburger deluxe from blah, blah, blah. He ate the cheeseburger. At 1 o'clock, I asked him, would you like to use the bathroom again? At 2:30, do you want to take a break? All of that stuff was documented. So when the defense attorney says, you exhausted my client. My client was starving. He wanted to sleep. And you have all of that covered. I told them, you want to take a break? Are you hungry? Do you need to use the bathroom? Being treated like a human being. Because, a defendant could be in a room for 12 or 14 or 24 hours, for that matter. And to make sure you document all of those things, because that's where the defense attorney's going.
Right. It's funny to hear you, because I'm completely on the same page with you about paperwork. When I first started out, there was sort of a philosophy, actually a culture within the police department, that detectives shouldn't write anything down because they were creating information that is, it's known as Jenks information, the Jenks Act.
It's called discovery, yeah.
Yeah, it would get turned over in discovery. Yeah. And, our office worked very closely with the police department over the years in training new officers and training detectives on an ongoing basis to create the most exact and the most precise and the most complete reports possible. Because, for two reasons. If you're writing it down, as you're writing it down, if it's the truth isn't going to change. You're not. The second thing is, you're just not going to remember later on. So I got in the habit, even with in my job, I wasn't going to be a witness in any of my cases, and so my work product was not going to get turned over to the defense. But for the second reason, I wrote down everything that I was doing on a particular case, and I would always, the best officers that I dealt with were always the officers who kept the most meticulous, the most honest, the most authentic reports. And the other thing where that came into play was, I worked in the last gang case that I tried with an ATF agent named Sam Ward, who's top notch, one of the best law enforcement officers I worked with. But when I was interviewing a witness, he would be the one who would basically memorialize what the witness was saying in the course of that meeting. I didn't want to be taking notes myself because that would interfere with my eye contact with the witness, which is really important. He was such a good report writer. I knew that whatever he wrote down, he would write it up this in the next day. I got a report the day after that, and it would be something that we had the facts. We had them down. I didn't care if anybody got that in discovery. That was going to be something that was going to be the truth. And if at some point during the course of the interview, I had to press up or he had to press up on the witness, and say, that doesn't make sense. Why are you saying this? Or is that really true? That was all documented as well. So it's really an essential part of not just good police work, but I think good prosecutorial work as well.
No, absolutely. And I think one of the most important things about the interview process, first, before you go in and speak to someone, is to know so many truths about that person so that when they start lying to you, you can use those truths that you know to uncover the truth, because when someone gets confronted with a lie, lots of times they come around and start telling the truth because they know that you know they're lying, you know?
Right.
The other thing is patience. Really good detective interviewers have tremendous patience and they're good listeners, you know?
Well, one thing that in Rock Creek, I'm not going to give away any endings or whatever, but I will say that, that a mistake in a police report is something that leads to a very important revelation about who the killer was in the case. That's all I'll say. But as I was writing it, I wrote up these reports. They are fictionalized reports written by a law enforcement officer. But I had a good time writing them because I had read so many police reports that had been written by good writers that I could mimic the style. And it was just fun to actually have to include within one of these reports a clue that ends up solving the murder.
But Kevin, remember, you never get out of a car, you exit a car.
Yeah.
When you start writing like a copper, yeah, this is police lingo. Yeah, I Bill Cannon, citizen, I get out of a car. Sergeant Cannon, cop, exits the car.
Right. That literally was an example that I would use over the years in training officers into how to write a report and how to sound like a human being instead of a law enforcement officer.
Right, right. Instead of a robot. New York Transit Police had this expression that I just thought was the funniest thing. I arrived on the scene and the perp fled to parts unknown. I was like, where the hell did that expression come from? He fled somewhere. I don't know. Where did it go? Where did it come from over the years? He fled to parts unknown. I just thought it was funny. You know, a copism. I love copisms.
Yeah.
So, Kevin, with this book, we're already in an hour. It's like, you know, all we needed today was to have some Coronas, and we could this could have taken place at a bar, you know. But
well, I get up in New York. My kids both have graduated from law school, and I get up to New York, and we should do that sometime. I'd love to knock back a few with you.
That would be great, and we're both Irish, so we know we all like to tip a few, you know.
Well, there's a spot that that my family and I went to called Foley's, not far from the Garden, and it was just the best sports memorabilia I've ever seen.
Yeah, I know that place.
And it closed down last year. We went back. We were going to go back, and it closed down. It was a legend up there for years, but I'm sure we'll be able to find another Irish bar.
You know, the most famous bar in Manhattan North was this place called Coogan's, and it was on 165th Street, right near Columbia Presbyterian. And when they opened up, it was like Indian country. You know, there were arrows flying through the window. It was a dangerous, dangerous neighborhood. And they survived. And in fact, Columbia University owned their building. And they were going to lose their lease because Columbia wanted to jack up the rent to like five times what they were paying. And everyone in the community got behind Coogan's. And then Columbia University gave them a lease. And everyone else was being kicked out because of the political pressure. Then COVID hit. And they had to close.
Yeah.
And it was so bad because all the owners were in their 70s and they had been in the bar business their whole life. And, you know, even closed, I think they were paying like $40,000 or $50,000 a month for their bills when they were closed. So they couldn't afford to be closed for 2 years.
Right. Yeah.
They gave it up. You know, this little New York story. But that was our favorite bar. You know, it was like they used to call it, you know, like the watering hole for, you know, it was almost like a Cheers type place. You know,
right.
Went there, lawyers went there, drug dealers went there, and everyone knew this is Coogan's. Don't mess around in Coogan's, you know, which is pretty cool. So, Kevin, it seems like we didn't talk as much about your book as I thought because we sort of got derailed, but I think that will tell people, you know what you're talking about. And you come from a background of prosecution, you come from a background of, investigating these homicides, and you're going to bring the truth to this novel. And I think it's got to be a hell of an interesting read.
Well, it was a lot of fun to write. I'll say that the writing is tough. It's rewarding to create a world that didn't actually exist. I mean, actually, the world of 1952 existed. You're putting people who didn't exist though in that world, and it's fun to use your imagination like that. My first book was nonfiction. It is easier to work off a narrative that actually happened than it is to create a completely different world. But it was fun, and I get asked sometimes, you know, how did I outline this? Do you know from start to finish, how every chapter is going to work out? You know who the murderer was at the end of even when you start. And I didn't know who the killer was going to be until halfway through. The characters kind of take off on you a little bit because the more you write about them, the more you're seeing different sides of their personality, and they interact differently with each other. And it's a very, I sound kind of strange talking like this because they're all my own creations, right? But they take on a life of their own. So it was fun to write.
Yeah, but Kevin, could you write about characters if you hadn't met all these characters during your 35-year career? Chances are no. And I just want to bring up one thing, having said that. One of my favorite all-time police show, and I think is clearly knocks it out of the park, the most realistic, is The Wire on HBO. Was absolutely, they caught the language of the street. And the writers wrote the language of the street and it was believable. You know, sometimes you'll hear language on TV and you're like, that's not what the guy would say. You know, what bullshit. I mean, The Wire, those writers were amazing. And the dialogue was incredible. And it was true police work. I remember when I saw there was a scene where I think McNulty was retiring. And they were in this bar and everyone was playing like Irish songs. And I had tears rolling down my face. It was so realistic that's the way it really is, you know?
Right.
And somehow they caught that. And not just with the police scenes, but with the relationships between the perpetrators and the drug dealers and, you know, the whole triangle of power in the drug trade. They caught that like amazingly.
Yeah, it was amazing. One of the writers of of the, I think season two on of The Wire, was a guy named George Pelicanos, who had, he's actually a DC writer, and he's written a lot of very gritty, you know, crime novels about the streets of DC. And I would read his stuff back before he's not writing as many novels anymore. He's more more doing for TV and movies, but he was for entertainment, I should say. But yeah, the way he captured the streets of DC was the same way that show captured the streets of Baltimore.
But you know something, you couldn't do that unless you got your ass out there and met these people. You know what I mean?
Right.
I have a friend that's an FBI agent. He's a talking head on all the TV shows now, Bobby Chacon. And he says a problem, he wrote for Criminal Minds for a while. He was trying to write some other TV shows. The problem is these producers now want you to make characters that are unrealistic. Oh, make the head guy a gay Hispanic man. Or, you know, or make him a woke lesbian female Asian. Like, wait a minute. These are true stories. That's not who the character was, you know? And look, I think Budweiser learned their lesson from that, right? But maybe TV won't.
Well, it's yeah. The one thing that you do learn over the course of doing, you know, what I did for all those years was that you know, there are just certain, some stereotypes are pernicious and negative, and some actually apply. And one of the stereotypes that actually is something that is persistent is, you know, how people interact with each other and how people interact with other members of their group that they identify with, and the extent to which people who are sort of outside a particular group are identified. And I let me be specific here. I talked earlier about the 87 crews in DC. They are they're so segmented that DC, in terms of the streets, is still to this day segmented, such that if somebody goes from one part of Southeast, moves from one part of Southeast, hangs around with a particular crew, and they move a mile away, for example, they stand out and they are someone who is perceived as a rival, even though they're in the same quadrant of the city. They've only moved even just two blocks away. Two of the gangs that warred with each other for years were 5th and O and 7th and O. The 5th and O gang, 7th and O gang, two blocks apart. These gang members would go to the same schools. They would get-
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list: teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
They hung with the same people, but then there was something about long-standing disputes that went back years in between people. Well,
Kevin, they're protecting a corner that they don't own. You know what I mean? Yeah,
right.
Like this corner, this bullshit corner that's, you don't own this corner, whether you're pitching crack, marijuana, whatever you're pitching on this corner, you don't own it, you know, but they're willing to die for it though, you know?
Yeah. It's, the last gang trial that I had, it was a gang, two gangs in Southeast that were literally divided by one road. One was associated with a neighborhood called Waller Place. One was associated with a neighborhood called Trenton Park. And they went to the same junior high school. They interrelated. Everything seemed fine, except there was a flashpoint, and all of a sudden they were divided into two different groups. And there was no crossing. There was no crossing the lines. There was nobody who could straddle those two groups. Anybody who was straddling was at risk of basically getting attacked by one side or the other side or both sides. So people tend to end up identifying themselves with a particular group, and they stay with that group. And there's a certain tribalism that goes with that.
You know, we used to laugh and say, he fled. And, you know, it was Manhattan. Yeah, he probably went to the Bronx. You know, like, he fled the jurisdiction. Yeah, he went one borough over, you know. But that was a joke we used to have. But, you know, sometimes there was a lot of, in Washington Heights, they would flee back to the Dominican Republic, you know, sometimes. But it was a homicide joke. Oh, yeah, they fled real far. He was in the Bronx. Yeah. We went over the bridge and we found him, you know. Kevin, we're at an hour and 11 minutes. I'm going to give you your final thoughts. And please, when it's over, I'm going to play our outro song. Please stick around for a few minutes.
I sure will.
Your final thoughts on our discussion today and your book. I mean, obviously, we seemed like we got a little bit away from your book because it was so interesting. We touched on so many different. Rock Creek is the book. That's the park. Here's the cover of the book. You can get the book on Amazon. It's a novel by Kevin Flynn, a 35-year Washington, D.C. prosecutor. Your final thoughts, Kevin?
I really very much appreciate being on, Bill. I left the job last year because I was because this book was coming out, and you can't really serve two masters. You if you have a book out, you can't. You can't do the promotion. You can't sort of like move on to a next book, which I'd be interested in doing. But I missed that job so much. I missed the day to day of it. And I even toyed with the idea of going back. But one of the things I missed the most was just is the camaraderie of working with police officers, other prosecutors, and just being at it every day. And you were at it every day for all those years. I miss it a lot. I hope my love for the job, I hope my love for law enforcement, I hope my love for the city, if this is the city of my birth, I hope all of that's reflected in Rock Creek, and that readers who know D.C. will appreciate what this book brings as a story about D.C., and that people who don't know D.C. look at it as being resonant of their own hometown and their own experiences, and how the experiences portrayed or depicted from 50, 60, 70 years ago are very similar and have resonances here today for what we as a culture are still going through.
Very well said, because you know something, Washington, D.C. could be Washington Heights. It could be Harlem. It could be Jackson Heights, Queens. You know, it could be Staten Island. Could be Brooklyn, Crown Heights, you know, do or die, Bed-Stuy, as we used to call it. You know, culturally it's similar, and inner city is culturally, no matter what state it is, and it's very similar, and the people in law enforcement learn these cultures, and you couldn't survive if you did not. It goes for the prosecutors, the police, and the entire criminal justice system. I'll give you one last word, then we're going to go to the outro.
Sure. It's funny because you and I talked off camera about the show that was on Netflix. I think it's called Homicide New York.
Yes.
And there was a segment. One of the segments featured a case that came out of East Harlem. And the detective. First, I loved the series generally. I mentioned to you that I loved it for the people, the detectives, how they came off. But I was really struck by the detective who was describing the case that happened in East Harlem, and how he was describing that neighborhood and his love for the neighborhood and his love for the culture and his love for the music and his love for the people. And, you know, there are there are criminal elements in every part of society, but I do think, and I think, and I hope the book really captures this, that there's more good to people than there is bad. The protagonist of the book, Shane Kinnick, is a detective. He's tormented by World War II. He has severe substance abuse and other issues, but he is a good cop trying to do the right thing. At the end of the day, I'm not going to give away any endings, but if there's a message to be found in the book about law enforcement in general, it is that there are many more good than bad, and that the best are really the best kind of people that there are, because they're putting their lives in the line, they're putting their careers in the line, and they're doing the best they can to make sure that justice gets done in the end.
You know, I know I'm prejudiced with this statement, but cops are pretty good people, you know, overall. They're really just a bunch of shitbirds. every profession has them. But as a profession, most of them are really good people, you know, family people, you know, people, loyal people, people that will risk their life for their brother, you know. So it's, I don't think you can say much more about that. So the book, again, well, I'll give it one more plug before we leave. The book is Rock Creek. The author is Kevin Flynn. Folks, this has been part of the Police Off the Cuff author and crime series, and Kevin Flynn is the author. It's been my privilege to have interviewed Kevin. We just met each other. It's like we've known each other for years. So, folks, have a great day, and we will see you the next time.
One episode just ain't enough.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.